From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Mavis Beatty, one of Bletchley Park's leading female codebreakers, died this week at the age of 92. Mavis's work on Enigma was crucial to the Royal Navy's victory at Matapan in 1941 and the success of the D-Day landings in 1944. She was part of Dilly Knox's team, working on as-yet unbroken codes and ciphers. In this Bletchley Park podcast extra, we can hear her chatting with Bletchley Park historian and author Michael Smith.
So, you were Mavis Lever when you arrived at Bletchley Park, weren't you?
Oh, yes, that's right. Yes, I was only 19. I hadn't got married then. No.
How did you come to be selected for Bletchley Park?
Well, I was studying German literature at University College London, and I was hoping to embark on a thesis on the German Romantics, and I was all booked in to go to Tübingen University, which is right in the centre of all, absolutely besotted with German Romanticism. But Munich came, and so they cancelled my Tübingen term, and so I went to Zurich University instead. And so I stayed there till actually the war, well, was looking very imminent. And by the time I got home, the Siegfried line was being manned. So I just got back in time to UCL and found they were evacuating to Aberystwyth. So I really thought, well, I don't know, I ought to do something better for the war effort than reading German poetry in Wales. Especially as I then found out that Dr. Goebbels had got his doctorate on German Romanticism, so I thought, well, there must be something wrong with the German Romantics. So I said I'd trained to be a nurse, and they said, oh, no, you don't use your German, so go and see what the Foreign Office can do with you. So off I went, and oh dear, we were all interviewed by a formidable Miss Moore, and we were just all checked over in our CVs and so forth. She seemed very satisfied with the fact that I didn't want to go to Aberystwyth, and that was a sort of brownie point. And so we were all sort of written down, and that was it. But then, when I went back home, I was asked to go to MI6 in London, 54 Broadway buildings right off of St. James's Park. And I thought, well, I was getting rather excited. I thought I might be going to be a spy, and Martha Harriet wasn't in it. But I didn't think my legs were good enough for that, never mind the German. So off I went to what was the same government code cycle school, but it was all part of, because in fact, what we call the other side, the real spies were on the floor above, but we never allowed to talk to them. We just said hello in the lift and so on. But it was very mundane. But what we were trying to do in the phony war was to stop the war starting. So in political warfare and in economics, we were trying to blacklist all the people who are sending commodities to Germany that they shouldn't be, and check it out. Oh dear, oil drums, I remember, came to it an awful lot in the code book. So it really was all quite straightforward, but you had to know where it was coming from, because that was important to define where, of course, the culprit was. And I was put on to looking for something called St. Goch, they said, Saint, capital G-O-C-H. So I was chasing all this saint around the world. And it always pays off, like Alice in Wonderland, to ask innocent questions. And it was just through sheer ignorance. I said to them, well, how do you know when there's a capital letter in Morse code? And they said, well, we don't. You can't. So I said, well, why have you asked me to look for St. Goch? And so I said, well, perhaps if we look at it differently. So I wrote it down all in one, S-T-G-O, and said I thought it might be Santiago, Chile. And they were slightly taken aback, and so was I. It's just one of those spur of the moment. Well, it's like a crossword, isn't it? I mean, yeah. It just suddenly it dawned on you. And I suppose they thought, you know, here's a bright young thing. And that's the sort of thing that Dilly Knox would like. I can only assume that because I was told to go to Bletchley. Most people didn't know where they were going. They were just put on a train and arrived, but I did know where I was going, and I was told immediately to go to Dilly Knox, and that was it. So that was very nice.
Dilly Knox, you'd never heard the name before, presumably?
Well, yes, I think I had, yeah. Actually. I'd heard of Ronnie Knox rather than yeah. Dilly Knox, and I think I must have... I think I just had heard, but not because he was a Greek scholar or anything, but just because I've heard of Vivo Knox, who was in Punch, and this remarkable...
He was all sorts of things, wasn't he, Dilly? I mean, he'd been in the code-breaking business for a long time.
Oh, yes. Well, he'd been in it from 1914 in Room 40, and that was the time that they were really going for classicists, and this is unusual in... that our country did this. They came from Cambridge, and he was a papyrologist, and he had really been unravelling Greek papyri, charred in the desert sands. And also, one of the first things he did when he got to Room 40, our First World War co-breaking place, that he was given some charred remains from a zeppelin of a code, which he broke right away. And another thing is, he approached it entirely linguistically, just as though it were a papyri, whatever it was. It was a puzzle, and I think he thought it was rather nice that Enigma was the Greek for puzzle later on when we were doing Enigmas. So that the sort of thing he did, and I think this is extremely characteristic of how he saw everything code-breaking as linguistic patterns and rhythms and so on, and... he actually saw that and we're talking about hand cipher days, of course, that the commonest bigram in German is EN. So he'd seen this bigram repeated across the cipher text and in a strange, orderly sort of fashion. And he recognised that EN, EN would be dactyls and so on, as it rhymed, and that he reckoned it must be poetry, and because it was in that particular rhythm, that it would be romantic poems. So he said, oh, yes, German romantics, bound to be some roses around. And so he guessed one to be roses. And then he potted down. He wasn't so into Schiller and so on as he was into his Greeks. And the chap said, oh, yes, I know that one. And they found the poet of Schiller it came from, and that broke the U-boat code. So it was a little bit like that.
It's astonishing, isn't it, that something like German poetry could be used to break...
But he always looked for patterns, and not necessarily when it came to the Second World War, that you had... Although we did actually have poetry sometimes thrown in. They say we're padding out a message. So
At the end of the First World War, they had this skit, didn't they, on... Lewis Carroll and Alice...
Yes, that was a beautiful one, Alice in ID 25.
Yeah.
A really lovely one. Well, the most extraordinary thing, and Penelope Fitzgerald wrote a wonderful biography of her uncles. Of course, she didn't know much. Well, she did know about that of the First World War, but of course she didn't know anything about Bletchley when she came to write. But she said to me, can you tell me what my uncle said to me when you first were taken over the cottage to meet him? And I said, yes. He looked up from wreaths of smoke and said, have you got a pencil? Because we're breaking machines. Of course, I had no idea what an Enigma machine was or anything that mattered. So he said, here, look, have a go. And he passed this bundle of gibberish over to me. And I just said... but it's all Greek to me, because, of course, I didn't know he was a Greek professor. And he just laughed and said, oh, I wish it were. And Penelope said to me, but you know what you're saying, don't you? I said, no, what am I saying? She said, well, they wrote a skit after the war, Alice in ID 25, and that Alice said exactly what you did when she went into Dilly the Dodo's room. She said, but it's all Greek to me. And he said, I wish it were. And we were actually, at the time, my husband was treasurer of Christchurch, and his rooms looked over Alice's garden. And I was actually writing a book on Lewis Carroll myself. And that was where I just couldn't believe it, that she said, well, you've said exactly what Alice said in the First World War. So there's something for you.
So you were Dilly's Alice coming in
well,
to the cottage.
He was my white knight, he really was. He was so concerned about one's welfare, very courteous and, trying to see you through. And, I always thought of Dilly as my white knight.
Yeah. And, of course, he did surround himself with young women. Some people have misunderstood
well,
that.
Well, this was a myth that still goes around. I'm afraid I've seen it all over all sorts of books, that Dilly had just, when he settled in the cottage and wanted and began to expand when the Enigma machine was broken, he went round the park looking for the most attractive girls and that we were, Dilly's girls were a sort of a harem, which couldn't be further from the truth because he hadn't seen any of us before we arrived. He'd got our CVs, that's what he asked for, and he picked out the sort of people who were language orientated, and I've only just realised just recently how he picked them, because one was an actress, a couple had been trained at drama schools, and now there was a speech therapist, and we were all into speech therapy since the King's Speech. How the voice and the sounds and so on matter so much. And, of course, I mean, the obvious one, that I was a linguist. I mean, that he needed German linguists. And perhaps my little St. Gough triumph had percolated his ears, I don't know. But anyhow, we did hit it off quite well. And we were always referred to as Dilly's girls, even in high places in Whitehall. But what he liked so much about us is that, we were obviously fairly intelligent and we could make good coffee. But the point being that, to begin with, he only had Welshman and Turing and Peter Twin, who were mathematicians, working with him. And his ideas just went off like a Catherine wheel. I mean, he just had bright ideas after bright ideas. But it was no use asking Welshman or Turing to see them through because they were too busy with their own ideas. But we were prepared, Margaret Rock and I, who were, I suppose, his chief assistants, she'd be trying to work out what he said yesterday, and I'd be trying to pin down something he said today. And there were so many of them, perhaps we had six bright ideas to work through, and one of them would work. But if he hadn't had us to pin these bright ideas down, I think perhaps it wouldn't have worked so well for him.
There is this strange thing that lots of mathematicians are drawn in to Kobrecki, and of course Alastair Denniston, the head of GCNCS, had actively sought out mathematicians. But Dilly was completely different from that mathematical approach. His approach was much more looking at weird sort of ways of logic.
It's a very strange form of lateral thinking that brings in a lot of memory. I mean, let's say that perhaps this is a silly thing to say, but mathematicians and logicians tend to go deep into. But his thinking was just an extraordinary ability to make connections, and of course, as a papyrologist and so on, he was absolutely trained in unraveling things, so that. It was totally different. But they only started to bring mathematicians in after they'd heard of the great success of the Poles, because they started, when they first had an Enigma machine, they brought mathematicians in right away. And Rudzewski brilliantly broke it. But he only broke it theoretically. He says this himself. And so does Gordon Welshman, who was our chief mathematician to begin with, that he couldn't have done it, that the theory would have taken too long. It was a very elegant theory, but he couldn't have done it without the pinches. When I say that, so that's the cryptographic spying that the French did when they actually got material messages and instructions of how to work the machine and so on. They actually got it from a German cipher clerk. And when these were produced, then Rudzewski was able to apply in the same way what Dilly was doing, but Dilly didn't have a theory with it. What he did was, as soon as the commercial machine came on the market, the Enigma machine, in the 1920s. And of course, it was intended for banks and industry to keep things secure. I mean, nobody really thought of it being the outcome of battles and so forth. But we had one, and the GCNCS did buy one on the open market when the patent came to England. And then he started to play with it right away. He and Hugh Foss did understand its workings. And this was a great help to us, because when we came to do our own Typex machine, a coding machine, it was much more secure than the German ones, because they'd already seen the snags, although they'd never had an opportunity, because they weren't getting any German messages. The frequency was too low for them, whereas they were getting it in Poland. They knew how it could be done, whereas, of course, Rudziewski by then had done it. But all Dilly did then was to sit down with his machine, this commercial machine, and type out messages to himself and see how to do it. So he had seen the original commercial machine, but not the adaptations that they made when they were adapted for wartime use in Germany and Italy and Spain and so on. So that's how he did it. But then, of course, he had to go on to try the big one that the Germans had really introduced, with a plug board extra and so forth. He had to go on to that. So he really left that until it started up again.
He broke the Enigma machine first during the Spanish Civil War.
Well, that was it, you see, that in 1937, when the Spanish War started, it was found that, by which time, I don't know whether, because the machine was made in Germany, a German factory in Berlin, and I'm not sure, I don't think we quite know I think it even happened before Hitler's day that they got onto this, but whether Hitler then, when he was trying to find how to beat the Versailles Treaty and so on, whether he actually stopped the issue of them. But you couldn't get them anymore without permission. Hitler had come to power by the time of the Spanish Civil War, of course. And although they were meant to be neutral, of course, Italy and Germany were both helping Franco, and they needed to talk to each other. And so he allowed them to have these machines. And that's one of the ones, of course, we have at Bletchley which is so important, which we should probably hear about.
And that is not as secure a machine as the German military.
No, because they got the extra plug board as well as the
The military machines had a plug board, this one didn't. And that was the same type the Italians were
they're
using.
Absolutely. They all, even our Typex, they're all fundamentally, as Scherbius designed them in 1920, with the idea of the reciprocating thing. Now, that's not quite true. The very first one that they did was a huge thing, and it wasn't reciprocal, but that was nonsense, really, because, you see, if you've got two operators, one at one end and one the other, it's got to be reciprocal. Otherwise, if you press A and get L, and he's got L to press L and A, which, of course, is the absolute weakness of any encoding machine, because of the fact... And the other thing, of course, too, which Dilly had found out in the early days when he was practicing on it, that if you press E, you'll get anything else except E. That it would short-circuit, it just cannot. The electrical contacts won't allow it to be itself. So there are the two factors he would have found out in 1920, or anybody else who played these games, that you couldn't decipher yourself the thing itself, and that it is reciprocal.
Yeah. Now, that brings us neatly onto Matapan. Tell me, when you started breaking the Italian Enigma and you began to get messages about this battle, can you talk about that a bit?
Well, June 1940, Italy came into the war. So the first thing that really want to know is, are they by any chance, the Navy, still using the same thing they did in the Civil War? Because after all, the Civil War only ended in 1939, so that there was a good chance that it might do So, as I say, we hadn't got the machine, but we had all the theory. And so we tried to look at the messages that were coming in and see if they could be broken. But unfortunately, they weren't the same. They were going not necessarily going to naval people. They were going to some of the colonies, to Asmara and so forth. And so that there was nothing, what we call crib, you know, you don't know how to begin.
Yes, yeah. You're not familiar with the sort of language that's going to be used.
Perhaps you might begin referimento, referring to, or something, but there was nothing like that to build on because we didn't know the type of correspondence that they were doing. So what Dilly said is that we would just see if it started with the word to, P-E-R, and then an X. Now, what he did, I've got here some rods. Now, these are exactly, in actual fact, are the sort of hand cipher, as it were, interpretation of how the wheels go round and how you put two together. He had done this, you see, already as part of the theory, so that if you had a text that began G, you found G along this particular rod, and you wanted it to begin P, you put P with it, so you put G and P. And then you could read off other things that the electrical contact would have made when he pressed it elsewhere, and you had to start reading things. Well, what he said, well, because we were all at a very menial task stage, all we had to do was to put up these rods, and he wanted you to put up P in the text and E in the text and so forth. And then if it worked, and it didn't look too awful further down the line, to pass it on to him. Well, I was all on my own one night, and I couldn't put up P-E-R-X, but what I could put up, well, every time I wanted to put up the R in this, and we had to do it in 78 positions, so I can tell you how absolutely tedious and you pink-eyed you are by the time you finish. But it kept on putting up an S and it came up of its own accord, P-E-R-S. Well, I was told to throw it out at that stage, but I didn't. I thought, well, supposing it's not Perex, it might be Personale. So I put up the rods for Personale and something else came up, and there was the next pair. And so I got to P-E-R-X. And then it went off beautifully all down the line. I found there was a GN for senior and there was something else, you know. So I was able to fill in my lovely Italian crossword puzzle. And we only had the tiniest little Italian dictionaries, you know, pocket dictionaries. We didn't have anything special. So I filled in the whole column. And then I thought, well, you see, every so often after it's had its 26 run, it will turn over, and it could turn over at any stage between 2 and 3 or 8 and 9 or anything. Well, fortunately, I had quite a good run for my money, but I knew I'd got to get it off the other side because I then got to get the wheel wiring for the middle wheel. So I didn't really know, but I thought it through what I must do. I must take all the couplings through and then see if on another rod square that day. And to my utter astonishment, it worked. And so when Dilly came in the next morning, I handed him the whole text. He couldn't believe. He said, well, I couldn't either. Really, the Duke, it was so easy. Because, as I say, it was simply because I was following Dilly's methods, and we called this game, it's like a game of Scrabble, rodding, but it's really like driving a car without not going on, no, we got under the bonnet. I mean, you didn't really need to know how the machine worked. Mm. And many of the girls who were excellent at this Scrabble Robin game could break them very easily. So that, anyhow, Dilly was very pleased. And now, where were we? This was some...
Was that your first great triumph?
Yes.
For Dilly?
Yes, we were just expecting invasion, weren't we? Yes, of course, in September 14. But he said he'd like to take me out to dinner, and he's a dreadful driver. And there were tank traps up Watling Street. He just drove straight through them. And they were slightly shaken. But however, he took me out to dinner, which was very, very nice, and he was very kind. And then I was promoted from being a backroom girl into the front room where the, Well, it was only Margaret Rock who really was his assistant at the time. So then I became his assistant, and that was the beginning of it all, which was very nice.
And so we're still in this period of coming up to Matapan, and you're working on Italian.
Yes, well, now we knew that we got the right machine, and yeah. that if any messages came, that I must say that you see, part of they'd said right from the beginning when Scherbius produced the machine, that you could change the wheel wirings so that you didn't quite know how often they would change and which would upset the whole. You'd need whole new sets of rods and everything because it is working out the electrical contacts and so forth. So then it did happen that we'd obviously struck that period, but we got a new wheel wire. But fortunately, now we're talking about November 1940 now, but fortunately, because they had to have a standard volume of traffic, it was no use if you were going to do anything in the Navy or having six messages a day when you were only usually had one or none at all, so that they sent out a standard volume of dummies, which sometimes they just slid their finger down the keyboard and didn't even bother to encipher it. Well, you can see that a mile off, and just as well, because it would have been dreadful if they had really enciphered something like something out of Dante's Inferno and you'd spent all day only to find you'd got a passage from Dante. But no, it wasn't that. But what this man did, my operator, that I picked up a message, and this is something that may seem remarkable, but when you just live with letters and, I can do the alphabet backwards and quertzu backwards and what a number is to W is 23 and all that sort of thing. I mean, you've done it day in, day out. So that you wouldn't need to analyse it in any way. But I picked up this long, long message and thought, good heavens, there isn't an L in it. And then I realised what this dud was, this one that was just not proper traffic. The L is the last on the keyboard on the Enigma. And this chap had hit L all the way and probably had a fag at the same time, and then it had come out this long encipherment, which was in fact nearly 100 letter crib of how I could rod it all out. However, that was a tricky one because owing to the repetitive nature of the L, it wasn't as easy as it might have been. So I always seem to be on night duty on my own when these things happen. But I went over to Hut 6, of course, is where they were doing all the big army and air force stuff. And because there were some of Welshman's mathematicians there, whom Dilly called Wrangler Coves. That was out of his Lewis Carroll days, not Burgraves, but Wrangler Coves. And so I found a Wrangler. And so he very kindly helped. And we, together with lots of coffee, a much more logical approach, we did in fact break the wiring. This, I would like to say, was love at first sight, but it wasn't. But this was my husband-to-be. But we like to remember in later years that our life began on an L dud. However, there was some time later when he was actually seconded to Dilly's section, much later, that happened. But so then we were all ready for Matapan because we'd got, fortunately, the wheel wiring, which they were using at the time of Matapan. And then, normally, you see, one didn't ever know, and this is what we can't get people to understand, that if you're a codebreaker, you didn't necessarily know what the messages were saying, that once you broke one message for a day, that the setting which the operator was using would cover the rest of the day, and you just took it through to a machinist who ran it all off, so that you might break a message which said nothing to report, and you wouldn't know something later on which was just what General so-and-so wanted or somebody else wanted, because we just didn't know, because that was not the way need-to-know worked, as you know what MI6 means. Nowadays, everybody seems to think that need to know means right to know, because it means exactly the opposite, isn't it? That you must only know the bit that's yours, you don't know what the other, so you can never see the whole picture in MI6. So that was fine. However, Matapam was different because the first message, a tiny message, said, today's the day -3, X-3. Oh, goodness, the Italians are going to do something. What is it they're going to do? And this was, of course, 3 days before Matapan, so that was the 25th of March, 41, and that was when we got the message. So then we heard what was going to happen on D-Day -2 the next day. We were up all night, of course, and then we're waiting for the next day, D-Day 1, and then D-Day. So we everything had to get out to Cunningham in time.
Cunningham was the head of...
Oh, sorry, yes, he was the admiral that... Well, of course, it was a marvellous battle because it was at a very bleak time, March 1941.
That's right, yeah.
And, of course, traditionally, a naval victory is very good for the British public. And Churchill was over the moon, and he said that there was nothing like it, no fight since Trafalgar, and Cunningham was as good as Nelson and so on. And then came the message through from the Admiralty at midnight, tell Dilly we have won a great victory in the Mediterranean, and it's all thanks to him and his girls. So that, of course, imagine what that was like to a bunch of 19-year-olds. We were terribly pleased about that.
So, but of course, when Cunningham is in Alexandria, I think, and the Italians are going to attack these British naval convoys that are taking troops from Greece to... I think it was... troops and supplies from Greece to Egypt,
Greece.
Cunningham has to have found this out by some way other than Ultra, doesn't he? He can't...
Well, yes, and of course, I mean, but starting off with the -3, even that was a great help to Cunningham because he had great distances to overcome in the Mediterranean. He might have been at Malta and... But fortunately, he was on the way to Alexandria, so that was a base for him.
Yeah.
But this is what was so different about Matapan, that normally the messages took a long time when they went out. Everything had to be done through the Admiralty. Now, the Army and Air Force had already got a much better system in place, which was... done through Richard Gambier Paris. This was that it should go straight to the commander in the field by means of a personal special liaison officer. And this was, I say, working well. And Dilly had always thought, well, almost long before Matapan, as soon as we broke the first Italian message, he said, and this was what was called Ultra to begin with, now the word Ultra is used just to cover anything that came from usually the German or side of Enigma. But this meant that there was to be a special service, and that it would, instead of going up to London and through all the bureaucracy, that it would go straight to the commander in the field, i.e. Cunningham. But normally the Navy would have nothing to do with that because they said it was all very fine for the generals because they had a lot of tactics and strategy on site that they had to make their own decisions. But everything, as one knows when one hears about poor Nelson, how everything came from the Admiralty and how he had to keep the logbook of every bit of what he was doing. So they said it was... nothing would ever bypass the Admiralty, but fortunately, the Director of Naval Intelligence, who was a great friend of Dilly's, Admiral Godfrey, and it was he who sent the message through at the end of the battle, he managed somehow to get through, and this was the first and only time that it was sent out by Ultra, that is to say, and Cairo had only just started up with its intelligence service in the beginning of March. It was jolly lucky, you know, that they could then get it straight out to Alexandria, and then one of the new SLU would take it by actually a mobile unit. In this case, it was a converted Packard that they did in Richard Gambier Paris' unit at Wadden, and... that was taken straight to Cunningham. And but one of the other things is the outro is, was that they must always have a cover up for it. There's no way that this secret source could be ever revealed. You've always got to, which was most unusual, it would look as though it was coming from the commander. In fact, I've got all the Admiralty messages and right up to that moment, even right up to the 25th of March. It was, Cunningham was reporting as though he was answering them. And then quite suddenly on the 27th, he have said, "I have decided to take the battle fleet in." That this is when, because up till then, they'd only thought it was just a small attack on the convoys. What actually had started us off in the cottage, we had had a tip-off from the Luftwaffe people in Hut 6 that there was some talk of the Germans, the Luftwaffe, actually escorting the Italians, doing something, and it was guessed that they were going to attack this convoy, but they weren't. So they had put in place, the Admiralty had put in place, a routine arrangement for cruisers and so forth to cover it. But at that moment, Cunningham wasn't there and had certainly not decided to take his battle feet, to take war supply. But when he heard that the Victoria Veneto, which of course was Mussolini's pride and joy, it wasn't just a few to attack our convoys, it was meant to be much more of a battle. It was then he writes down, "I have decided to do this." And it's that moment that everything changed. So what they had to do for a cover-up was always, well, in the case of naval particularly, was aerial reconnaissance. So they got a flying pan, a plane that they knew when the Italians had left anyhow, to go near enough, but not very near, just near enough for them to spot the fact that they might have been spotted.
So the Italians thought that actually it was this aircraft that had spotted them, and no one would think it was anything to do with
the flying pilot. Yes, the reconnaissance. It was aerial reconnaissance. Yes, yeah. And so that if they then realised that something had gone wrong, they wouldn't have thought that. And you can see that throughout. And Dilly was very funny about this, because after this message had come through and we were all terribly excited, he wrote a poem. He's very good at poems. And this is actually composed on the next day. And it's called Swollen Heads. And this is every one of us girls who took part in it. But it's referring always to us as the cottage aeroplane, you see, because so he says, "When Cunningham won at Matapan by the grace of God and Claire," now Claire was someone who was our prefect, she always kept all our jam jars in order. We only kept our rods in jam jars and cocoa tins and mustn't spill them on the floor because the cleaner might pick them up and find them and so on. So Claire was really our prefect. So when Cunningham won at Matapan by the grace of God of Claire, for she pilots well the aeroplane that spotted their fleet from the air, you see. And then when Cunningham won at Matapan by the grace of God of Jane, and she was the girl who spotted the Wops from the cottage aeroplane. And so it goes on. I must say, I was lucky because it all depends on your rhyme, but I had rather a good one. I wasn't in the aeroplane, apparently. But when Cunningham won at Matapan by the grace of God and Mavis, like unto a black swan, praise heaven, she is a very rare Avis. So it's nice that rare Avis and Mavis style. I mean, just is the way Dilly's mind works. And so then it goes on and on. And everybody is, oh yes, there's another one here. Oh, because Margaret, as I said, is one of his chief assistants. And when Cunningham Matapan, by the grace of God and Margaret, it was thanks to that girl, the Admiral said, that our aeroplanes straggled their targets. And he even mentions the tea lady, because one of the girl's mothers, who happened to be live locally, she was brought in so that we wouldn't have to wrestle with a cantankerous urn in the middle of the night. Uh-huh. So we had a poem. So even Mrs. Balance is also given an honourable mention in Swollen Heads, and so it goes on. But this is the sort of thing that Dilly would toss off Yeah. This is done the day after Mettelbaum. But yeah. when he heard that, you know, that it's all due to Gilly and his girls, he obviously thought we mustn't think too much of ourselves. So he produces the swollen heads.
But then Cunningham, of course, comes up and thanks you, doesn't
he? Oh, Cunningham, yes. Cunningham came himself. Oh, no, not quite as quickly as that, but a few months afterwards when he was on leave. And we, Admiral Godfrey brought him over, and we rushed down to the Eight Bells at the end of the road to get some drink, some wine. And I'm sure it wasn't up to what the standard CNC Mediterranean was used to, but he also drank to us, and that was very nice. And then, of course, it was all on the screens, everybody's screens on the cinema. And we would have loved to have told our parents we'd had a hand in it, but we couldn't do that for 30 years. Yes. People just cannot believe that people could keep their mouths shut for 30 years.
Was that drummed into you from the very start?
Oh, absolutely. We had signed the Official Secrets Act when we didn't know whether we'd be shot or not, but we didn't. That is the most remarkable thing, that 8,000 people get their mouths shut. We didn't have all these reporters snooping around or Newsnight, trying to find out what on earth you were doing. I mean, there was nothing like that. It just becomes a habit. And that is the trouble, that there's something, well, perhaps they ought to have a psychologist at us, but when things are buried for 30 years, they are tremendously far down. But it's quite different with Keith and myself, because we were doing the same thing. See, there were another couple married, or several couples married, but even when they were in different sections, they never told each other what they were doing.
Obviously, a mathematical background does help with code-breaking in some cases, because Rejewski had a complete mathematical background. But you've spoken already about the limitations of that.
Well, the limitations come entirely with Enigma, and I must make clear that I know nothing about anything else. You see, there's this Lorentz machine, which is the one that Colossus is the big machine for, because that does definitely require mathematics. There's no two ways about that, the numinary and the testary and so on.
Yeah. Well, how could modern computers have assisted in deciphering Enigma codes? They would have been able to do it quite quickly.
Well, they can. Modern computers are entirely different from what we had. It was Turing's bomb that motivated it, but there was not... I think it's often said quite wrongly that this is the beginning of a computer. It is not that one at all. This was not a programmable computer at all. It was the Colossus machine. The bomb did no more than take what I was doing on my rods and mechanize it. It all had to be broken. I mean, the bomb could never break a wheel wiring or anything. It had to be exactly what they called the menu that was given it, was just instead of my doing 78 times, that it did it by mechanisation. In fact, Turing is on record of saying, if I had 6,000 Chinamen, I would never have needed a bomb. Well, we weren't 6,000 exactly, but that's what we were doing. We were slogging away at rodding and doing the handwork, whereas the bomb was not a computer. It took that and mechanised it, and could never have been done without it, because whereas we could do six a day, there were thousands coming in every day with the army traffic, and so that it could never have happened without the bomb.
Keith, actually, while he was in Hut 6, perhaps we can cover this now, Keith was working on the Brown Enigma cipher, wasn't he,
debate over
Coventry?
He took his tripos in 1940, just as they were charging across Belgium, and Gordon Welshman brought him to Bletchley, because he did very well in the tripos, and then he was put on to Brown, which was the beams that the Luftwaffe were coming in on, and he actually was on duty on the night of Coventry, and he was absolutely devastated, because he has written something down in his memoirs now, that was the one night, because R.V. Jones had managed with this Nickerbine to bend the beam so that quite often the target was missed and fell in the countryside or something. But unfortunately, they just could not break it the night of Coventry. And he said how devastating it was because they had to watch the bombers go over. They knew they were going to the Midlands, and they watched them go over Bletchley, and they could not understand this one time of all times that they were unable to break Brown, which is terribly important. Even this year, they were trying to rehash this thing about Churchill having known that it was going to be Coventry, but they couldn't warn them because it would give Indigo away. That absolute nonsense.
Just one of those myths that
well,
grow
that's
out
it,
of
and
these
it
things.
Gets built on, and then there was a play written about it, and it was played again this year. In fact, they rang me from BBC Coventry, and I had 10 minutes to be able to read out this statement from Keith.
Yes.
Which I was trying to find desperately all over my non-existent files. But the interesting thing is why Keith has written these memoirs is that he normally just would not. He talked as little as he could. He didn't mind. He wrote for the Action This Day and so on technical matters, but he didn't indulge in personal anecdotes and so forth. But he was approached. He was Trinity Cambridge, and they said they were so tired of having tourists all around Cambridge pointing out the college that the four spies came from, Brunton, Burgess, and Jane Philby, and so on, that they could he possibly tell them something good about that could come out of Trinity. So there are only two, and very many more, of course, Milner Barry. Yeah,
there were quite a lot of codebreakers came from
the
Trinity.
Only two left were Ralphnowskis and Keith. So Keith has written his memoirs, which I've only recently sent them, and that's where he mentions Coventry. Well, I other people have probably said it, but it's the first time it's been written down, as far as I know.
And one of the things about Dilly that you told me originally, I remember, to explain this sort of logic sequence that he had, this lateral thinking he had, was that he asked you which way a clock went round.
Oh, yes. That was one of his great things, you see. Which way does a clock go round? Well, that's okay if you're the clock, or you say stupidly it's clockwise. But you see, if you're the machine, it's the opposite. So if you're inside the clock, it's the opposite too. But he had this extraordinary way of, well, we've got used to it, and remarkable sort of ellipses that you have to leap a mile to get. And we got onto this much more difficult Abwehr machine with the Secret Service one, which had lots of turnovers and so on. He'd say, and Margaret and I were meant to understand this, and we did, actually. Now, if there are two cows crossing the road, there must be a time when there's only one, and we want to find that.
Right.
And that was how.
Well, this is the Abwehr machine that
you're
working on.
That's the next, much more difficult.
And that section became that's really what it worked on towards the end of the war, isn't it? The second half of the war.
But I think you see what was the total difference between sheer mathematics is the fact that it's the operator as nonsense, the procedural errors. The Poles, who've written this all up, of course, very well, their side of things, talk about Knox's methods as procedural errors. He just went straight for the operators, that they were going to do something, because he was used to scribes doing the wrong thing in his papyri, you know, they cut corners and things, and he knew that it was the chap somewhere who was going to let it down, which of course was absolutely true, because it's the key setting that the operator's got to work when he's told, either through a code book, which is unusual. Matapan was a code book, that they had their settings, that they were each given this little booklet and told Monday this and Tuesday the other and so forth. But usually it was internal, that the operator had to decide what his indicator was and then encode it, and so that the other one was doing it the other way around. So it was meant to be safe, but of course it wasn't, because, you know, all sorts of giveaways in there. And particularly because there are four wheels, counting the reflector, and so that they have to think up a four-letter word to put in their little, the little windows that show up on the Enigma machine. Well, you know, as Freud said, that nothing is random, and they're not going to put up random. They put up girls' names. I know two operators who had girlfriends called Rosa, one in the Balkans and one in Madrid. And also they put up four-letter dirty German words, which are obviously a great asset. And in a moment of tension, that's just what you would do. So I'm a very good expert on dirty German words. And the worst message I ever really saw was one that said from German headquarters, reprimanding one operator in Spain, I think he was, for doing just that, saying, you shouldn't do that because young girls are having to decipher it. Not me, of course, but the German girls. So it's nice they got that, at least they got that motto. Courtesy.
Yeah. Just a couple of things on Dilly. It's odd that Dilly was so, you know, he was the one who was thinking, oh, we've got to have a different way of showing how Cunningham got hold of this information on Matapan, the aerial reconnaissance. And he was the one pushing very hard for that. Mm. And yet, when it came to being in the Home Guard, he wasn't actually very militarily aware, was he?
Oh, yes. I said this to his niece, Penelope, when they were practising in the stable yard opposite the cottage. We were only glad that they had broomsticks, because if they'd had rifles, it would have been the end of us. And she said, oh, don't you believe it? In spite of his poor eyesight, my uncle was a very good shot. So, I don't know.
Well, he was.
Mm, so they said. Mm.
Yeah. Also, I've been told about this anecdote about pigeons I must ask you about. And I don't know the anecdote myself, so you were allowed to release some pigeons?
Oh, yes. Well, you see, MI6 was actually in charge of the pigeons, weren't they? And we had, for a time, agents traffic coming, our own agents coming in. But that ended with Station X when they took the wireless down, because it was obviously going to draw attention. But they left the pigeons in the pigeon loft in the stable yard, and those were sent out for the resistance. And they even sent out double cross messages by pigeons too.
Really?
Yes, for the use naturally of the resistance. I know very well, because he was a very nice man in charge of them, and they weren't let off at Bletchley. It was quite near London in a park, and we used to get lifts to London with the pigeons sometimes, because obviously, and then we could get a tube into London. I don't know where it was, but I've actually let the pigeons off. I remember letting them all out one day in the middle of whichever park it was near London. But no, we certainly had pigeons in the loft.
They watching were all them all fly off south.
Mm, oh yes, yes, and they came back, and some of them got awards. You can get awards for bravery if you're a pigeon too. And they've got, I think they've still got those at Bletchley, they've kept some. No, there was everything. It was a real spy world, birds, even down to pigeons.
You were talking actually about Keith and yourself working in the same section. Mm. So this has helped you remember it. So you probably remember it much better than most people who work there.
That's what I'm saying, that we are better at it, simply because we've met people, because Keith went on to be treasurer of Christchurch. We've met a lot of people, you know, people like Asa Briggs and Roy Jenkins and everybody who were there. We just chatted from time to time. And
discussed it between the two of you as well.
Oh, yes, you have to be careful about the kids, even so. When Winterbottom's book came out in 1974, and we were absolutely horrified at the ultra secret with picture of Bletchley on the front, but we didn't take any notice, and we didn't think this was the moment to tell the kids why we were so good at Scrabble and so forth. But I remember when I say how easy it is for me to know there are no L's in a dud and that all of this, because your eyes are all so trained to it. And I remember once my daughter Elizabeth was working in the holidays in the stacks in the Bodleian, and you know they go down about 20 floors, and she said, oh dear, I was working on J floor today. And I said, what, 10 floors down? That's a long way floor. She said, how did you know J was 10? So I said, don't you? So you can get caught up.
Well, thank you very much, Mavis. That's wonderful.
Okay.
thanks to the staff, volunteers and veterans of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk or find us on iTunes. Also, follow us on Twitter, where we are at @BParkPodcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.